The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is the Takeaway podcast for Wednesday, September 14th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. This summer, a movement called hashtag Bank Black encouraged those protesting police brutality to move their money to Black-owned banks. Now, those banks are reporting a huge boost, thousands of new accounts opened, and a growth in assets amounting to about $6 million. Rapper Killer Mike is credited with popularizing the hashtag earlier this summer. Here he is in an interview with Hot 107.9. He's urging listeners to take immediate action.
You can go to your bank tomorrow and you can say, until you as a corporation start to speak on our behalf, I want all my money. Right. And I'm taking all my money to Citizens Trust. Right now, they ain't saying march, hold hand speech. I'm saying take your money out of this dog's hands, out of their paws. Take your money.
Killer Mike's bank, Citizens Trust, is based in Atlanta. It's one of only 23 Black-owned banks, credit unions, or savings and loan associations in the United States. Today, we're looking back at the historical intersection of race and banking and asking, will this movement boost, prompt long-term growth? Joining our discussion is Terry Williams, president of One United Bank, the largest Black-owned bank in the country. Terry, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Mirza Baradaran, professor of law at the University of Georgia and author of How the Other Half Banks. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Terry Williams, what has this recent infusion of cash meant for your bank?
It has been a significant infusion in terms of deposits. And what it really has meant is that the Black community is finally starting to recognize the power of our spending dollars. We spend about $1.2 trillion a year in annual spending, and most of that spending is spent, actually only 2% of it or so, is actually spent in the Black community, which makes it very difficult for us to, you know, build wealth and to grow Black-owned businesses.
And Black banks aren't new, of course. They've been around for a long time. But overall, they are struggling. There are far fewer banks like yours now, even than there were before the financial collapse of 2008. So is this latest movement something significant that can help bring the power of Black banks back, do you think?
The short answer is yes, but I also just want to sort of clarify the struggling that's been happening in the Black banking sector. Part of that was a result of the recession, but part of that was really a result of a need to invest in technology. And a lot of the Black-owned banks were small and just didn't have the resources to invest in online banking and mobile banking and bill pay. And so that I'd call it that journey of having to move to a much more technologically based industry is one in which we did lose some of our Black-owned banks. But I think the ones that are remaining that you can see do have that technology are actually here to stay.
Professor Mirza Baradaran, where historically has been the economic power of Black banks? I mean, checking and savings is fine, and that's one thing for a community bank. But the real economic power of banks, of course, is in mortgages, in lending, larger lending, business lending, and counteracting the kind of discrimination historically that African Americans have experienced when trying to bank in white-owned corporate banks.
This industry has ebbed and flowed through time, and often you see the industry rise after there's a significant hardship, right? So you've got an industry that's responding to discrimination and segregation. And so when you've got, you know, say the Great Migration or some of the, you know, civil rights movements, you see this rise in Black banks. So it's an industry that's been robust, but back and forth through time. These institutions that are needed to help communities escape poverty, as Terry was saying, you know, there's this wealth gap. and black banks are really at the center of trying to do this. They are the engines of wealth growth in the black community. But often these engines end up being victims of that same poverty. So it's the same sort of catch-22. As she said, they're small banks. They have a hard time catching up with technology. And that's exactly because the sort of circumstances that fuel their development also end up causing their demise.
Terry Williams, I mean, part of the professor's point there is that the point of black banks in the first place was to counteract a long legacy of things like redlining, housing discrimination, predatory lending. But if you grow up within that ecosystem, it's hard to grow to a point where you can fight back against that kind of discrimination.
You know, it's sort of interesting. I mentioned how technology really caused the demise of some of the smaller banks, but I also think it is going to actually allow the remaining banks to prosper. Because one of the challenges that we've had as a community is, you're exactly right, it's how do we serve the community while at the same time, you know, remain, you know, safe and sound. And one of the ways that technology helps that is that there are actually African Americans that don't directly live in the low to moderate income communities that we serve, whose dollars, whose deposit dollars could really help us serve those communities. And technology allows those individuals who are either African-American or allies of the African-American community to deposit money into these black-owned banks, which gives us low-cost funding that allows us to do the type of lending that is necessary for these banks to grow.
Right. I mean, this means that anyone who can read a hashtag from wherever they are or hear about one can get on the internet or get on an app and put money in your bank.
Right. And it's, you know, FDIC insured. Our rates are, you know, competitive rates. And, you know, as we always say to people, it's still your money, you know, so it's not like it's a, you know, contribution. It really is a deposit. But what it does is it provides lower cost funding to, you know, black owned banks, which allows us to offer the lending services that we need to offer to these communities.
Professor Baradaran, I wonder if infusions of $6 to $10 million like we've seen, while that's impressive, how far that really goes in a world where, you know, Terry's bank is going up against Wells Fargo or Citibank, giant corporations. Is that a significant amount of cash in the real world? And how much more would this technologically driven movement need for a bank like Terry's or other black banks to really start to compete in ways that are that make an impact in the community?
The question I want to answer is, will these banks make a dent in the wealth gap? I think the answer is they will try, and they're the only ones trying, but that it takes a lot more than these banks. And just as an example, I mean, you've got, this is an industry that's been going since, like I said, the Civil War, before Abraham Lincoln is assassinated, the month before he's assassinated, he signs into law the Freedmen Savings Bank. That's the first black bank, and it was Frederick Douglass was its president later. But, you know, as it turned out, those funds just disappeared, right? And so throughout history, there's been these black banks, many over time. There's 20 now, but before the Great Depression, there were 135 black banks across the country, really robust sector. And what I've seen through studying these banks over time is that unless the bigger conditions change, unless we are not segregated, unless there isn't a wealth cap, these banks alone can't bridge that gap.
So Terry Williams, what's next for you and One United Bank? There's this movement, there's Bank Black, $6 to $10 million on the way in, some attention from your community and from the media. What's next?
Our next step is to continue this movement to really push people to not only move their money, but to change their mindset, to move their mind, as we're calling it, and start to realize that, you know, that black money matters and that this is part protest in terms of taking money out of large institutions and putting them in black-owned banks. But it's also, you know, part progress in that we need, as the black community, we need to focus on our money. We need to be financially responsible. We need to figure out how to buy from black-owned businesses. We need to figure out how to bank black. We need to figure out how to move our community. There have been studies to show that if we could increase the amount of business that we give to black-owned businesses, we could create a million jobs in the black community. So we need to do that. That's something we can do on our own without government support, without anybody's support. So what we need to do is what we can do, what we have control over, what positive steps we can take. And I think if we, and when, I should say, when when we take those steps, I think others will come around. And I think that, you know, this is the beginning of the movement. Anytime you have a movement, you know, it always starts and trickles, but then it grows. And that's what we're seeing.
Terry Williams is president of One United Bank, and Mirza Baradaran, professor of law at the University of Georgia and author of The Color of Money, A History of Black Banking, out in 2017 from Harvard University Press. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Basket of deplorables.
Deplorables.
Deplorable?
Deplorable.
Deplorable?
Basket of deplorables.
Let's talk about this presidential campaign's deplorables for just a minute. Hillary Clinton set the news media and Donald Trump supporters on fire on Friday when she let it slip at a fundraiser that Donald Trump supporters sit in two baskets.
You could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Ooh, that was a gaffe. A presidential candidate vilifying millions of voters. Ouch. News outlets from the Washington Post to Fox News groaned at Hillary's mistake. They called it a self-inflicted wound, and they followed it up with analysis, calling voters racist, Islamophobic, xenophobic, sexist. Just how badly had Hillary hurt herself with them?
They just gave Trump this.
Oh, yeah.
It's a silver platter.
But here's the thing. I'm not in Hillary Clinton's head, and no one at the campaign has told me that she said that on purpose. But if she didn't, it's a gaffe with nothing but upside for Hillary Clinton. And the Trump campaign knows it. Let's stop for 1 second, though, and look at the worst part of how the media covered Clinton's comment. Lots of analysis on how unfair it is to call half of Donald Trump's supporters racially biased. Lots more on how it's always a bad idea to attack voters of any stripe. And almost no coverage on whether the claim is true. And plenty of polls, which are the best answer we have, suggest that it is. As Ta-Nehisi Coates at The Atlantic has pointed out, polls have asked this question. According to a Reuters Ipsos poll, 60% of Trump supporters have a negative view of Islam. 76% in a Texas politics poll support banning Muslims from the United States. And again, according to Reuters, nearly half of Republicans rated blacks as more violent and more criminal than whites. So there is some evidence that Clinton's claim may in fact be true. But I get it. This is politics. Truth-telling is not always a good idea, right? What's the definition of a gaffe? After all, it's when a politician tells the truth unintentionally. So forget that this is not the first time Hillary Clinton has suggested Trump's followers have ugly politics. Mitt Romney attacked the 47% of people in this country who want a free handout, and it was terrible for him. Well, this really hurts Hillary, right? Calling half of Trump's supporters deplorable? Well, not really. The thing you have to ask yourself is, who exactly does this gaffe hurt her with? Now, I'm going to speculate here, but safely speculate. Let's face it, not one Trump supporter truly offended by what Clinton said about them was gettable for Clinton in the first place. That person doesn't exist. That person's a unicorn. Instead, there's a big group out there who might be willing to vote for Donald Trump, but they just aren't sure. They're Republicans or independents, but they don't like what he says. They don't like his insults, and they don't like what they see among his strongest supporters. That's right. They're queasy about getting into that basket. How do I know this is true? Well, Donald Trump knows it's true. It's his strategy. Donald Trump's ceiling so far in this campaign has been about 43%. He's barely broken it, and that's not enough to win. So he's been busy staging outreach to African Americans and Latinos. And as we've reported on this show, that outreach has less to do with getting minority voters and has a lot more to do with making nervous whites comfortable. Of course, the word deplorable sent the Trump campaign into a frenzy.
Anybody that doesn't support her or her candidacy or appears to support Trump, you belong in this so-called basket of deplorables.
Sure, they're fundraising off of it. But all of this umbrage is belied by the fact that it's built into Trump's own campaign, a recognition that lots of white Republicans and independents are uncomfortable with Trump and his supporters. He's running on it. So here comes Clinton. Half of Trump's supporters are deplorable. The media covers it as a gaffe, and that guarantees more coverage than if it were written into a teleprompter speech, which it actually was. Meanwhile, Trump's true deplorables, the racists, the white nationalists, they're flying their flag more proudly than ever, happy to get called out by Clinton. Hillary Clinton's comment was panned by pundits and journalists for attacking voters for dividing the country. But it didn't divide the country. The country is already divided. Clinton has a lead in this race, albeit a narrow one. What she did was try to divide Trump from the already very uneasy Republican white voters he needs to have a chance to win in November. I have no idea if it will work, but if it was an unintentional bit of honesty, if it's a gaffe, it sure looks like a pretty savvy one from Hillary Clinton. And it helps guarantee that lots of American voters, as they watch the media coverage of this election, will start thinking hard about that question. What basket are you in?
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Boston Light is the last manned lighthouse in America. It's also the nation's first and oldest lighthouse station. And this year, the Boston Light is marking a major milestone. The Massachusetts Lighthouse Station, located on Little Brewster Island in Boston Harbor, is turning 300 years old today. The original lighthouse tower was built by the British back in 1716, and that was before the Brits destroyed it during the Revolution. Americans later rebuilt it. Today, Sally Snowman is the resident keeper of Boston Light, and she joins us now from the lighthouse. Sally, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm sure you get this question all the time, but in these days of GPS, global positioning, and electronic navigation, what does the lighthouse do these days?
It does what it did 300 years ago. It shines its light into Boston Harbor to make safe haven for mariners. And not everybody is wired for electronics, either in their neural pathways or on their vessels. Yes, for large ships and what have you that traverse the planet, they would have it. But there's still many that count on the visual aids to navigation, the floating aids that mark the channel going into the harbors and major ones like lighthouses.
So what is your day-to-day activity like? You're there with your husband at the lighthouse station, not the lighthouse itself, but is it the kind of solitary lifestyle that we're used to reading about for lighthouse keepers?
Romantically, we would hope so, but not necessarily, because it's a lot of work out here. We're on an island, and we have to remember to bring everything that we need when we get there. So it takes a lot of planning. But I just thoroughly enjoy seeing the far expanse of the universe, just seeing the open ocean, and then looking up into the sky of whatever color. And it's just a wonderful life experience to be able to have this job.
You must have pretty fantastic night sky out where you are. Is it far enough away from Boston that you can really see the night sky?
Well, what disrupts the seeing stars in the sky is at the top of the lighthouse, we have an 11-foot crystal made up of 336 individual prisms that's been there since 1859, with a 1,000-watt lamp that gets magnified to 2 million candle power. That's a bright light. And we have that optic rotating with 12 bullseyes, which are they're round, they're prisms, they magnify. So as that 1,000-watt lamp, it gets lined up to one of the 12 bullseyes, it puts out a stream of light, a beam. So when I'm on the island, I see 12 individual beams coming out that fall down to the horizon. So I don't need to walk around the island with a flashlight. It's not really, really bright, but it's enough light that you don't bump anything during the night.
Big celebrations are coming up. So what's the Coast Guard planning and what is Boston planning here?
We're going to do a symbolic relighting of the light. We're going to be shutting it down because it's automatic. So we're going to switch the light off and then turn it back on at sunset at 6:55. And the Coast Guard band is going to play Happy Birthday. I will be on the island pushing the go button, so I won't be listening to the band, but it's going to be awesome. We're only a mile away. I hope we have a west wind so we'll actually hear the band and the singing out here at Boston Light.
Sally Snowman, I can't thank you enough for extroverting yourself for us, because it's a great story and it's an honor to have you here because you're such a big part of it. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Sally Snowman, resident keeper of Boston Light, 300 years old today.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom framed prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
I'm Todd Zwillick. Welcome back to The Takeaway. After months of debate, Congress is still squabbling over how to spend $1.1 billion to address Zika. Meanwhile, Puerto Rico is the place struggling hardest with this crisis. Nearly 18,000 infections have been reported on the island. 1,500 of those cases were reported by pregnant women. The territory is already struggling with a massive debt crisis and is working with an existing health infrastructure that was barely sufficient before this virus showed up and strained the system. Nick Brown is former San Juan bureau chief for Reuters, and he contracted Zika while on assignment there. He's written about the illness, the uncertainty, and how this disease has come home for him and for his family. And he joins me now in studio. Nick Brown, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You wrote that at first getting Zika felt like a punch in the throat.
Yeah, I felt a sore throat on a Friday afternoon after I'd had a cigar on my deck. It's my lone vice, but it hung on for a few days. And I first thought it was smoke damage, but I figured maybe it was something worse after 3 days when I was basically chained to my bed, night sweats, fever chills, and just unable to get up.
How long did the symptoms last?
The symptoms lasted about 3 weeks. Initially, they lasted maybe a week and a half, and I got better for a few days. And then I had sort of a relapse like 4 or 5 days later.
So then you know you're sick. You get a little bit better. You get worse. You get better again. Mm-hmm. But you know there's this thing going around. Obviously, you're in the news. It's been in the news. There's an epidemic on the island. How do you go about finding out what's wrong with you?
Well, for a couple of days, you stay in denial and you say, there's no way it's Zika. Then you get a text message from your mother saying, I think this might be Zika, and you dismiss that as a mother's, you know, overwrought concerns. But, you know, the symptoms were consistent with it. So when I was in New York visiting my wife a couple days later, I decided to go to my longtime doctor there and get a blood test.
And?
And it was quite an experience, because my doctor had to sit on the phone with the New York City Health Department to request permission to give me that blood test, because at the time they were only testing people that had traveled to Zika outbreak areas and that had symptoms. So he first had to make sure I qualified. I guess I passed the test, and sure enough, the city health department okayed a blood test for me.
So you're in this situation where not only are you sick with a virus that we all know researchers and scientists know very little about, but is also contagious. You don't know how much of a danger you might be to other people. We haven't even talked about your wife yet.
Correct, yeah. That was one of the main questions I had, was how can I spread this? What risk is my wife going to be in now? And, you know, I didn't really get straight answers to that question at first. And, you know, that's a sign of I think, the evolving knowledge even in the medical community. You know, I was told sort of broadly to use condoms for 6 months. But you know, as you can imagine, there are other concerns. Can saliva spread it? What about other sex acts? So, you know, it turned into a discussion with my wife. And I think all couples that are dealing with this have to have the same discussions. You know, it doesn't just permeate your bloodstream. It permeates your day-to-day life and some of the more intimate elements of that life.
With all this uncertainty, you mentioned your wife and the obvious issues this has with safe sex between you and what exactly that means. But this is broader than just that, because with all of these unknowns about the virus, this has to get right in the middle of plans that you may have to have children someday. And I imagine she has those anxieties as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, I admit initially to being a bit glib about that, as kind of the male and as someone who is thinking initially first more just about the physical impacts of it on me. It's not until you've had the disease for a while that you realize what kind of a a time and energy suck it really can be on your marriage and on your day-to-day life. So, for example, it's easy to say, well, 6 months, you know, that's not the end of the world. But science is evolving on these issues by the day. And there is some concern that it could end up being longer than 6 months that you can transmit the virus. And so it's a constant conversation with doctors. It's turned into something that we have to constantly monitor.
Now, you're here in New York. You wrote about how strained the medical system in Puerto Rico was to begin with. When you first got sick, you didn't want to go to a doctor there because they don't take your insurance and also they're not reliable. Clearly, the medical system there is under enormous pressure even before 18,000 people were infected with a mosquito-borne virus.
Right. You know, Puerto Rico receives proportionately less federal Medicaid and Medicare funding than states because of its territory status. It is hemorrhaging doctors by the day. You add to that an island-wide Zika outbreak, that's certainly going to exacerbate those problems. But, you know, it's also important to note it's not just a medical resources problem or a healthcare problem. It's an economic problem. Puerto Ricans are very concerned that Zika is going to hurt the tourism industry. And it already has. And that's the last thing an island needs when it already has, you know, $70 billion of debt, a declining population, a 45% poverty rate. So frankly, there's some bitterness in Puerto Rico right now. There's some resentment at what they view as hysteria over this virus.
Meanwhile, the politics of funding has gotten mired up in a lot of unrelated issues on Capitol Hill. That federal money still hasn't been passed. And as someone experiencing this illness, I wonder how it makes you view the political process in this country when you are in the middle of a political fight, you know, a couple hundred miles away.
Well, it certainly puts things in perspective. And while, you know, I would be out of my element opining about federal policy, but certainly when you've got close to 18,000 people in Puerto Rico that have, you know, reported or been diagnosed with Zika, that means the number is actually a lot higher. And the CDC has been pretty clear that more funding is needed. And certainly I can attest to the impact that the disease has on your life.
And what about you at this point? Are you scared?
It is a little nerve-wracking. It's a source of stress. It's kind of a black cloud that you just have to, you know, go on with your day and try not to think too much about. But it's going to be a continuing conversation with doctors, and hopefully we'll get some answers sooner rather than later.
Well, I appreciate you coming here to talk about it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Nick Brown. He's former San Juan bureau chief for Reuters, and while on assignment in San Juan, he contracted the Zika virus.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. And LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Picture, if you can, for 1 minute, a map of the ocean floor. In the Atlantic Ocean, the continental shelf gives way to a steep descent into the Hatteras Abyssal Plain. Then it climbs back up at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. In the Pacific, the deepest part of the ocean is the Mariana Trench. The ocean floor has mountain ranges and valleys, just like dry land. And the map you're looking at also holds the key to plate tectonics, the theory that explains how continents shift and move. But few people know anything about the person behind this map, a woman named Marie Tharp.
Here is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and the unusual feature is it has this great big cleft in the middle of it.
Having a master's degree in geology was rare for a woman in the 1940s. Her own partner dismissed her findings as girl talk at first, but that didn't stop Marie Tharp from changing the field forever. Hallie Felt is author of Soundings, the story of the remarkable woman who mapped the ocean floor, and she says the map that we're envisioning today would not be possible were it not for Tharp.
Marie was an amazing woman who mapped the entire ocean floor between 1952 and 1977. She did it using sounding records, earthquake epicenters, and salinity measurements of the ocean, all sorts of different types of data to try and figure out what the ocean floor looked like, because no one knew what it looked like before she came along.
So let's talk a little bit more about that science of what Marie Tharp did, because the data and the technology was, by today's standards, really rudimentary.
Yeah, so what they were doing was taking out a ship, and the ship would have what's called a fathometer, which would basically print out on a long sheet of paper a profile of the ocean floor. She had like hundreds of these, and she took all of them and put them together into long, sort of, if you think about splicing or editing together images for movies. And when she first started off, she only had 6 tracks across the North Atlantic Ocean. And the way that I like to explain this to people is by saying, if you imagine 6 clotheslines strung across the ocean from North America to Europe or Africa.
What turned Marie Tharp on to doing this work in the first place?
She got her degree as an undergraduate in geology, and she went on to get a master's in geology. But then when she tried to find work, she was a woman in the 1940s, and it was right after World War II had ended, and there was really no room for her. So first she was working for an oil company in Oklahoma, and then she ends up in New York City. And she goes to Columbia University, where there's a newly formed geophysical lab, and she asks for a job, essentially. And because she'd had experience drafting, so doing scientific drawings, she was hired. But she was hired as a research assistant to work for men who were younger than her and didn't have the degrees that she had.
And so once she started generating this data, mapping the ocean floor, you know, the normal way we're used to this happening in the scientific world is you collect your data, you do your work, you publish your work, you get recognized for your work, and you advance because of your work. And Marie Tharp was not able to follow this pattern I'm describing.
No, it was really different for her. So because she was a woman, she actually wasn't allowed to go out on ships in the beginning of her career. So her data was collected by other people, usually by her scientific partner, Bruce Hazen. And he was the person who really got all of the funding for their work and who convinced people that it was important to do. Back in 1948, he came into her office with a bunch of boxes of these sounding records. The ones that I described were the rolls of paper, and said, we've got to do something with these. You know, gender comes in here as well, because it's not a job that really anyone wanted to do. And because she was a woman, she ended up doing it. And the unfortunate part is that once Bruce Hazen died and wasn't able to get the funding for their work, their mapping work, she was actually not able to do her work anymore.
So what's critical to the understanding that we have today, not only of the map of the ocean floor itself, but to our understanding of plate tectonics, of continents? What's been the real contribution from Marie Tharp to the field here?
Yeah, so it's really simple in the sense that she gave us a picture of what most of our Earth looks like. I've heard it described as, before her, if the Earth were a football, we only knew what the laces looked like. But after her, we knew what the entire football looked like. But the complex part is that she actually discovered a rift valley that runs around the entire Earth for 40,000 miles. And this rift valley is what was key to the development of the theory of plate tectonics. Now we know that two plates are moving apart from each other. They're actually being separated by magma that's coming up through the crust of the Earth. Marie was actually able to discover this by looking at core samples, which are like drills down into the Earth's crust, and then they're lifted out, and it kind of looks like a sand bottle. So you can see all the different layers of the Earth's crust, and you can date them. And using all of that kind of information, she got all of these very specific dots, and the dots looked like a mountain range, essentially. But then when she said, oh, okay, the crust in these places is really young, it must mean that magma's coming up and actually rebuilding the Earth's crust. And so she's the one who first mapped that. And without those maps and without that information, there wouldn't have been anything for other scientists to come along and look at and start to write the papers that are sort of thought of as the canon of plate tectonics, the papers that all came together and told people that, yes, we're living on an Earth that has plates that are moving.
Well, Hallie Felt, you said about writing and researching this biography. What's driven you to bring Marie Tharp out of relative obscurity, frankly, and write about her and publicize her in this way?
So when I first read about her, I was just completely fascinated because I hadn't thought about the ocean floor before. I hadn't thought about what it looked like. I hadn't thought about all the work that it took to map it because it's covered up by all that water. And then when I started reading about Marie herself, she just was such an amazing person who was so curious and really wanted to bring together art and science and give the general public a picture of what our Earth looked like. And she was doing it during a time when women were not really allowed to enter the sciences, or it was made very, very difficult for them. But she persevered and did one of the most important scientific projects of the 20th century, despite all of that.
And it seems to me at this point, you know, at the very least, the United States Navy could name a nuclear submarine after her. They would be out of business without the work that Marie Tharp did.
Yes, that's a fantastic idea I haven't heard of. So even today, actually, it's interesting you bring that up. The ocean floor is not mapped in extreme detail, so we really only have between 10 and 20% of the ocean floor mapped in detail. So in 2005, a submarine actually crashed into a mountain that they didn't know was there. So still much more work needs to be done.
Hallie Felt is the researcher and author of Soundings, the story of the remarkable woman who mapped the ocean floor, a book all about the life and the work of Marie Tharp. Hallie Felt, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, history is full of people like Marie Tharp who didn't get full credit for their work. Is there a historical figure who you think didn't get credit for the work that they did?
This is Patrick from Kauai. What historical figure do I think didn't get the credit for his work? That would be Scipio Africanus. If he hadn't defeated Hannibal in the Second Punic War, Western society would have a very, very different look than it does now.
Christina on Facebook writes, Sybil Ludington, never learned about her until I was well into adulthood, but she rode out on April 26, 1777 to warn the militia of incoming British forces. She was only 16 and rode more than twice the distance of that famous Paul Revere. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Leave your comments at facebook.com/thetakeaway. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.